Welcome to Naturally Nourished, a food is medicine podcast that delivers cutting-edge information and solutions for optimal health. Allie Miller is a nutrition expert sought out by the media and America's top medical institutes for her revolutionary functional medicine interventions. From disease treatment to prevention, every episode will empower you with ways to put yourself back in control of your health. Please note, the topics discussed are for educational purposes only and should not be used in place of any medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment from a licensed health professional. Now welcome your host, Allie Miller, integrative dietitian and owner of Naturally Nourished, and her vice president, integrative dietitian Carly Vogler.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode number 21 of the Naturally Nourished podcast. I am here today with Allie Miller.
Hey guys.
And I am super excited to talk about Allie's pregnancy story. Allie and I see each other probably 5 days, if not 6 or 7 a week. And I've gotten bits and pieces and asked her and got to pick her brain, but not entirely. So today I hope to fill in all the blanks and get all the details.
Yes, I am super excited, a little overwhelmed, and hoping that I can stay focused. So I think the plan was that we're going to talk this episode on prenatal planning and then my first trimester, because I'm sure our listeners do not want a 3, 4, or 5 hour episode. So I'm going to try to contain myself.
I'll keep you on track. It's okay.
Okay. I'm a little scared. I'll try not to overshare.
I want to start with talking about prenatal health. Our last episode, number 20, was all about infertility. I know you struggled getting pregnant with a little bit longer than you anticipated, and I've seen your struggle with endometriosis working with you, and even having to, you know, change your work days around your cycle because it was so intense. So let's start with talking about that a little bit.
Yeah. So I've always had, well, since early teens, right before and right when I was getting my first period, have always experienced hormonal issues. And unfortunately, they've gotten more severe with age. And that happens often with endometriosis because your endometrial lining thickens. And with age, more of those endometrial cells accumulate and cause inflammation within the body. And so I've always, from my early youth, was on birth control to control cramps from probably age 15 to 20. And then even throughout that period, even with the synthetic hormone regulation, I was on prescription pain medications during the first 2 days of my cycle. So I would be on NSAIDs, beyond over-the-counter doses of actual therapeutic prescription NSAIDs, codeine. I dealt with symptoms such as vomiting from the pain being so severe. So not true nausea, but vomiting from pain intolerance. Turning ghostly white. That's when Carly would be like, oh no, what do we have to do today?
Yeah, you can really see it. It's wild.
Yeah, I wear it on my face. I try to kind of power through. But after age 20, I went off of birth control because I started to really get into natural medicine and organic foods and didn't want to take anything synthetic to manage my moon cycle and help my body to find some hormonal balance. Unfortunately, when I went off of birth control, the symptoms got more severe. And then I was left with, trying to cope with the pain, really.
So let's start by backing up a little bit and just talking about what endometriosis is, because some people might not really be familiar with what it means.
Sure. So the endometrium is the tissue that lines the inside of your uterus. And in endometriosis, this tissue grows outside of the uterus, and this creates endometrial implantation throughout the body. So it can include your ovaries, it can include your bowel, it can include the tissue lining the pelvis, and then it can spread in some cases beyond this pelvic region, like into the legs is usually the secondary issue of focus. So what happens is this displaced tissue, the tissue outside of the uterus, continues to act as it normally would. So when you're actually having a cycle, the endometrial tissue in the other areas of your body thickens, breaks down, bleeds with each menstruation cycle. And so this displaced tissue has no way to exit the body. You're not actually going to have a period in your leg or in your pelvis or in other areas. And so this tissue becomes trapped and it upregulates a lot of inflammatory mediators. So things like interleukins, prostaglandins, cytokines. the way that it influences your body. I always described like legs as like barbed wire. So like chicken fence or barbed wire wrapped around your legs and being cramped or pulled or tightened. Severe cramps like a knife carving outside of your uterus. This is delightful, right?
Ouch, ouch.
Hip and back pain, quite severe. And then sometimes seeing also issues like blood clots and like I said, pretty severe cycle. The first 24 to 36 hours of the cycle were always the worst. And then once I would get through that part, I was fine on days 2, 3, 4, 5 of my menstruation.
It sounds so terrible.
Yes.
And this can obviously affect fertility because of scar tissue and inflammation.
Yes.
Can even attack a fertilized egg.
Right. Because of all that endometrial tissue in other areas, even if you do get healthy fertilization of an egg, the viability of a fertilized egg is very low because implantation is low due to the scarring.
So when you realized that you wanted to get pregnant, how did you approach your endometriosis?
So, you know, in the last probably 5 years of my endometriosis, I was starting to work with some elements of the adrenals and some stress management, probably for the last 3 years more specifically. And that's really when I needed it, when I was picking up, you know, running my own private practice. So I had already started working on adaptogenic herbs, addressing the HPA axis, and was more specifically starting to target my neurotransmitters and hormones. So in the last 9 months prior to my successful pregnancy, I started to look at the estrogen dominance element in my body. And so with the estrogen dominance, I started an estrogen detox, maybe even a year prior to getting pregnant, using I3C compounds and or DIM, and I'd kind of go back and forth. I had rerun my neurohormones in, I want to say, June, and I got pregnant in September. So, what is that, like 3 months?
July.
Yeah. July, August, September, 3 months. Three and then number six. Yeah, and number six and number nine. So I had rerun my hormones in June, I believe, or maybe end of May. And that's when I really started tailoring beyond the estrogen detox I had been doing the whole period of time. And I was getting some resolution from the severe cramping by just reducing that estrogen, but I started the bioidentical progesterone in those last 2.5 months leading up to getting pregnant, which I think was a huge turnkey. And then on the other elements that I was working, so the first things, you know, stress and the neurohormones, working with adaptogens, and then working with the estrogen dominance and low progesterone. The other piece of the puzzle was I did run the MRT test. So I also have a history of I do have autoimmune disease in the form of Raynaud's disease. And this plays a fun role with the endometriosis because Raynaud's is a vascular concern, also playing a role with neuropathy and things. And then the anemia from the endometriosis is all a fun, vicious cycle. But anyway, I was on my second round of the MRT diet. So the MRT diet, again, is the inflammatory food and chemical panel. And I had started that protocol in July. And it was probably a little before July, because I believe 4th of July I was on it. And within that protocol, I did in my second round of the MRT diet test positive for candidiasis or candida. So I ran a candida cleanse. When's your birthday, Carly?
June 12th.
June. I know it was when we were shopping for your birthday for some reason.
Your memory.
My little time
stamp. I tell you.
And so sometime in June, so I must have run the MRT maybe in April or something like that. Whatever. I was on that diet. I did the candida cleanse first and then started the strict MRT following the candida cleanse. And I remember what's interesting is I never dealt with digestive disease as far as like bloating. I never dealt with constipation or loose stools or undigested food particles in the bowel. So that's been one element of my health that I've really lucked out on and not had to do anything really functionally. But I do remember during the candida cleanse, feeling specifically all of the action being in my uterus. And I really remember being like, there is something happening in my uterine area. And at that time, I wasn't even as specifically targeted on pregnancy. We were still trying, but I remember really that being a big change that I experienced.
I remember you saying that. You could feel the cramping, and most people feel it in their stomach and have stool changes like you were talking about. And you were like, I feel this in my uterus, which clearly is where it was working.
Yeah. So the Candida Cleanse was that whole piece of the dysbiosis treatment. And then following that, I did the MRT diet. And so, you know, timeline, I guess, I got pregnant my 9th month of trying. I was on week 14 of the MRT protocol, so I had removed the reactive foods for over a 3-month period, just starting to bring back in some of those reactive yellows, and I was on my 2nd or 3rd month of the bioidentical progesterone, and then a aggressive estrogen detox I was on my 4th month of, but I had been doing a more mild estrogen detox for the last years following up.
So honestly, just shy of a year for someone who was coming from a really healthy place.
Yes.
In general, you were just working on, you know, balancing things out.
Yeah. I mean, I knew that the cards were stacked against me with the endometriosis. So I kind of took that, was it a triad or a whatever, 4-tiered approach, I guess. But, you know, those were things, I guess, like you're saying, that I was doing anyway for optimal health because I wanted the hormonal balance for optimal metabolism and blood sugar regulation. I wanted the stress response to help with my insomnia and anxiety, you know. So all of these were pieces of my journey to health that also, I think, coincidentally came into layered approach for fertility treatment.
So when you found out you were pregnant, what was the first thing that went through your mind? Kind of a loaded question.
I know. I think the first, so I was super excited. And then I had the immediate like, holy crap, now what? What was I thinking?
Can't go back.
Right. I think the immediate as a, you know, business owner and there was, you know, the processing of, okay, my husband works at, the business as well, Naturally Nourished, and it was the like, okay, how is this gonna work? We had to kind of process through. We had talked about it, but it wasn't real. So when it was real, that was the big thing was, okay, now that it's real, what do we do about this? And I think that there was a little bit of fear as well, fear of miscarriage, fear of ensuring that it was a real pregnancy, not trying to get too excited. Because honestly, although nine or 10 months isn't a extremely long time, you know, you do hear that in about 4 months you should get pregnant for most individuals. And so, like I said, I knew the cards were stacked up against me. And every month I would, because we were actively trying, in that interim period, I would think, like on my drive home from work in the silent space, like, I wonder if I'm pregnant right now, you know, and you just ruminate and overthink. And so I think there was a part of me that was a little fearful to be excited, but I was definitely excited.
I'm sure that's completely the norm too for everyone that goes through this. And what kind, were you having any symptoms? Could you tell? Did you feel differently at all?
When I found out I was pregnant, I was, I think, 2 or 3 days late. I had taken a pregnancy test maybe when I was 1 day late. However, I took it like in the middle of the day, and I knew that even if I was, it would be a diluted sample, probably wouldn't be accurate because your HGH is going to be the most concentrated in the morning urination, just like ketone strips and things like that. So I got like a kind of faint line. I remember I actually showed you, I had showed Brady and he was like, I don't think that's anything. And then I showed you on our way to the TV station. You were like, I don't know, girl, that might be something.
And I was more thinking if that was mine, I'd be a little nervous because that's not my plan right now.
Right. So I was kind of like, oh, I don't know. And then I waited another day and then tested and got a pretty significant positive. But the funny thing was that the reason why I had doubt was my mom was in town the weekend prior. And I was talking about, oh, my breasts are so swollen. And I was getting a little breakout action on my forehead. And I never have had an issue with any form of acne or pimples or anything like that. And I was like, I don't know. I might be pregnant. And she was like, there's no way you're pregnant. You're breaking out and your boobs hurt. You're going to have a period. I was like, okay. And it's so funny because it's the same symptoms, you know, that you'd have early pregnancy or period. So it's definitely hard to tell.
So when it was official, what'd you do next?
So, of course, I told Brady first thing. And we had our little freak out moment and then excitement moment and then not get too excited moment. And my big thing, you know, he, of course, wanted me to, like, call a doctor's office right away. Like, we need to confirm this and know that it's legit. And I really didn't want to go see a doctor right away. I knew I was doing everything right. I had been on a prenatal for over a year, and I was on a lot of specific supplemental support. So I knew that my body was in a nourished state. I was on a very specific anti-inflammatory diet. I really wanted to wait until week 8 or 9 when we knew that it would be a viable pregnancy. And by that, I mean that we could actually hear a heart rate, because that to me was really important. I didn't want to, you know, what else were they going to do? Do a blood test and a urine test for HGH. And I wanted to know that it was viable. And I wanted to know also that it wasn't ectopic or outside of the uterus. So that's a huge risk as well with, you know, miscarriage and things like that. So I said, let's just wait till they can do an intravaginal ultrasound. And I booked an appointment for actually my 31st birthday, which was kind of special. And that was at week 9. I had already taken the day off from work, and this was the only day I fit in between my patients. And it's so funny that I had to call 6 or 7 different doctor's offices to book the appointment, because so many refused to see me under the following conditions. I had a couple offices say, will you agree verbally to have a cesarean section? And I was like, no, not unless deemed medically necessary.
I did not know that this happened.
Yeah. So I had that at like 3 or 4. And then a couple of them were like, oh, no, ma'am, if you are pregnant, and, you know, they always ask, what's the last day of your cycle, blah, blah, blah. So I was at like, you know, 5 weeks at that time. I think I waited to even call until maybe week 6 or 7. And at that point, they're like, no, ma'am, you need to come in now to confirm, and then you need to come in again. And I was like, I'm not going to cancel patients and interrupt my business flow when there's absolutely nothing that's going to change. And so it took the 6th or 7th practice for me to get in with someone that would accept me as a patient to not see them till week 9, when they knew that was going to be 4 weeks or 3 weeks from the day I was calling. They all wanted to see me immediately. And I just think it's one of those. It kind of threw me off, of course, immediately, the cesarean section question, because that's an intervention that, I mean, I don't want to go into natural birthing today, but something that I'm not really on board with the trends that we're seeing in the States as far as increased rise. It's a huge medical bill, and so hospitals make a higher financial gain on cesarean versus vaginal delivery. And it's also more convenient for the OBGYN, but not so much for the woman or the baby. Is it the best environment to birth your child? You're not getting that vaginal inoculation of bacteria. And it wasn't something that I was excited about. So the financial element was really interesting. And then just getting me in for another visit to me made no sense either.
That's wild. So you waited 8 or 9 weeks until, I don't know, I guess not that it wasn't official, but that appointment that made it feel official, which is a long time.
Yeah, it was. And I really didn't, I mean, even at that point, you know, I had told family, really only direct family. And then at that time, I think I might have told staff at that time or right just before that. Yeah.
I think just before, yeah. Mm-hmm. So now in the first trimester that we're talking about, let's talk about symptoms and how are you feeling? What were you focusing on? Like, what was your big nutrition focus? Let's talk about where your head was.
So first trimester, fatigue was like no other. And that's really unique to me because I'm a pretty aggressive type A fiery go-getter. And I literally felt like I got hit by a truck. Both more physical fatigue than mental fatigue. I was dealing with some insomnia with severe stress and adrenal imbalance prior to getting pregnant. Again, I was treating it and managing it as best as I could. But once I got pregnant, I was sleeping and there was no problem. I would sometimes on a Saturday or Sunday sleep for 12 to 14 hours. And so my body was in heavy rest mode. And I think that that's because of all the cellular reproduction that's going on. I had Brady read an article about how your wife is, regardless of running a marathon, mowing the lawn, you know, all these different tasks that men do that could be arduous or difficult, she is working harder than you laying down. I was like, yes, sir.
I'll remember that one.
Right. I luckily did not experience nausea or morning sickness. I only had one episode of that, but I was really grateful to not experience the nausea. Headaches were severe for me. I dealt with, and I'm not someone that's been prone to migraines, but I did deal with pretty debilitating migraines only in the first trimester, and I think it really had to do with the surges of hormones and changes going on in my body. And then I also had some pretty severe shortness of breath, and hunger picked up towards the end of my first trimester. I think that's pretty much most of it. Oh, and then of course, how could I forget the frequent urination? That subsided in the second. Now it's pleasantly back in the third. But the frequent urination, the beginning part before you're technically showing in the abdomen, but you start to get pressure in the uterus on the bladder area, that was definitely a change for me.
And when you say that your hunger increased, was it for everything, anything? Did you have any specific cravings? What was going on food-wise?
So I'm not someone that had like a really significant food jag. I have throughout the pregnancy and definitely in the first trimester. I'm not sure though how much is nature versus nurture of carbohydrate cravings. I think there's a little part of it that is like, I deserve this.
Oh, yeah.
I can't have wine. I'm pregnant. I should have a treat.
The emotional part, too, because you're exhausted.
I do. And so I did have a higher carbohydrate. And now, you know, prior to this, I was pretty close to a ketogenic diet. I was likely more like 45 grams of carbs a day and some days 60, but never going beyond that. I probably shift my macronutrients. I've stayed really high fat. And probably the same amount of grams of protein, but the carbs went up from like the 45 to 60 world into more of like the 60 to 90 world with an occasional blip on the radar of like a 120.
Okay. Let's also talk about, you'd mentioned bioidentical progesterone.
Yes.
Probably a little bit controversial. How did your OBG feel about that? Did you talk to him about it or her? What were you using? I want some more details on that.
Yeah. So like I said, I was on my third month of the bioidentical progesterone, and I did have the neurohormone complete plus panel that I had run on myself for a second time. So the first time I ran it, which was about a year and a half prior, I saw that I was a little estrogen dominant. And so I had been working on an estrogen detox, and my progesterone at that time was moderate. However, even at that time, my estrogen quotient, or my estrogen progesterone relationship was imbalanced. So relative, I was still showing too low of progesterone. But I thought at that time, you know, the year and a half or 2 years prior, I wasn't ready to have a child. I was just going to slowly work to reduce the estrogen. Well, I started to bring in the progesterone as I did my second run of that panel. And I started the progesterone because of that estrogen-progesterone relationship. So I had successfully brought my estrogen down through the estrogen detox, but I knew that I still needed to bring my progesterone up for healthy implantation and healthy ovulation. And actually in that third month, I definitely noticed also that my cycle was getting better. I think it was a synergy because I was on the MRT diet and really strictly abiding by it the second time through. And then also on the bioidentical progesterone. So I'm sure that was addressing the endometriosis in synergy. The progesterone I was on was 20 to 40 milligrams based on my cycle. So days 12 through 28, I was doing 40 milligrams. Then I was just doing one pump most of the days leading up to that. So trying to follow the rhythm of the ovulatory cycle with a higher progesterone push in the kind of second and third tier of the 28-day cycle. And no, my OBGYN was not on board. He so I went to him. Like I said, I waited till week 8 or 9. It was the person that was willing to see me delayed. And I really wanted the data. I wanted to use my insurance policy as best I could. And I wanted to get that intervaginal ultrasound to know that it wasn't ectopic, to know that the baby had started developing inside the uterus, and to know that there was a viable heart rate. That was like my 1, 2, 3 check. And I told him, of course, I was a very prepared patient, and I had my bioidentical progesterone. I had all of my supplements at that time. And I told him that, you know, what I had done, I breezed over the diet part because I knew he would think diet had nothing to do with anything, of course, you know.
Yeah.
And I just said, you know, I want you to know that I'm taking this bioidentical progesterone. He looked at it and he was like, oh, is this prescribed? And I said, yes. And he was like, well, come into my office. And he printed me a case study of a 47-year-old woman with bioidentical hormone use. And so it wasn't even a fertility case. It was a 47-year-old female going through perimenopause and a case study. It wasn't a research study. This is like a single person's story, an anecdote. And and he's like, I really feel like you should read this. And I just kind of nodded my head and smiled and said, thank you. And, you know, he said, I'm on the board of obstetricians. And, you know, we really feel strongly against bioidenticals. We feel that pharmaceutical drugs are much more sound. And I want to write down these two. You know, one was Clomid, which is interesting because it really is a SERM, a selective estrogen modulator versus a progesterone-specific drug. But anyway, I want you to look at these drugs and, you know, I don't know. I can tell you that I'm not on board, but I can also say you could be pregnant because of the progesterone, so I'm not going to tell you to stop it. And so I was like, okay. And I knew I wasn't going to stop it anyway. And I said, well, I'd really like you to run my blood because I had just recently run the saliva and I wasn't really familiar with salivary markers of progesterone for fertility once you were pregnant. I knew they were supposed to be higher, of course, but there's really more research on saliva progesterone prior to pregnancy. There's more research on serum progesterone. So I was like, I'm just wondering where I'm falling serum. So I asked him to run my blood. And then I went ahead and at week 7, I had already actually increased. Once I found out I was pregnant, I went to 40 milligrams every day. And then at week 7, I increased to 60 milligrams. So I was at 60 when I met with him. And my plan was to stay on through week 12 when the placenta really independently picks up production. And that was done through my own research. He called me and my progesterone was in a level that he felt was a safe range. And again, he actually just said, you know, just keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks, Doc.
So yeah, he noted that initially he's not on board and he doesn't think it's a good idea. But then when he saw that I was in a really good state and I had told him that I had run low progesterone in the past in both blood and saliva, he was like, okay, well, you know, we'll just keep it going. And then around Thanksgiving, which was going to be around the week 12 period, you could slowly wean it or stop it. So it was kind of interesting. And Brady, my husband, was like, okay, Allie, take your hands off the wheel. You're not going to be the doctor of yourself through this pregnancy. And we'll see how that turned out for us.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
Now, the biggest thing that I have a lot of questions about, I'm sure other people do, is you want to do a natural birth. So
yeah.
Tell me about this whole process.
Yeah. So, I mean, I didn't anticipate him being on board. I'm as a naturopathic practitioner and using functional integrative medicine, I often am unfortunately disappointed with allopathic or conventional medical doctors. And much of the reason is that a lot of their research and influence is heavily infiltrated by monetary financial gain. Like I said, with the C-sections, with the additional visits, with the go on this medication, versus working with the rhythm of the body. So when I started researching, it was actually I didn't worry about it until I was pregnant. And that's actually surprising for me. I'm kind of a control freak. You would have thought I would like have a plan.
Yeah, I would.
Actually. So, yeah, I started researching in my first trimester. I met with a friend who had had 3 natural births herself. And I knew that she, of course, beyond her natural experience, she was a Montessori teacher. She taught ART, which is a respiratory technique. And so I met with her to get some actual points of what I should be looking for. So some of the things that I started looking into was a certified nurse midwife. And this is someone that has a master's of science in midwifery. This was really important to me because in the state of Texas, just like the word ND or naturopathic doctor, it's actually illegal. And the licensing of an ND can be very vague in the state of Texas. So you can call yourself a naturopathic doctor without having a master's degree in science. But like in Oregon, in Washington, in California, a naturopathic doctor has to have a naturopathic doctor's license. And that has to be done in medical school. So I wanted to have that same medical licensure for the midwife. So I wanted her to have at least a master's of science in midwifery. And that allowed her the ability, or him, but it was females that I was actually looking at, To carry oxygen, which is, of course, important for both baby post-delivery and mom. Pitocin for post-delivery hemorrhage. So Pitocin is what's typically used in the hospital setting to induce labor. And Pitocin in the hospital setting is, I think, something that I'm, well, I don't think, it's something that I'm against to induce labor in most cases because it blocks oxytocin. And oxytocin is that love, feel-good hormone. So a lot of women, when they're induced by Pitocin, that drives too intense of contractions. Then they're given higher amounts of pain medication or their epidural to counter the pain management that creates numbing. So they have to bump up the Pitocin to get the contractions going again. And it's this vicious cycle. And when the Pitocin gets too high, it can actually influence the emotional connection with the baby post-delivery and that kind of feel-good hormonal surge. So, you know, there's both that chicken and egg vicious cycle of leading to more medication intervention leads another medication intervention, which is not something I'm on board with. But at a home birth or Pitocin post-delivery, what that does is that helps with hemorrhage. So that helps to drive contractions to deliver the placenta following the delivery of the baby. And if you were having a slow, steady bleed, it helps actually with managing the blood flow. So that is something that I'm on board as an intervention when needed in a home birth. And I wanted to make sure that that was available to me because although I wanted a natural birth, I wanted it to be done as a smart birth. And I wanted to use the components of up-to-date science that makes sound information to me, make sound intervention without intervening in a harmful way.
Sure.
And then the last thing I wanted to make sure was that she could do an Apgar score. So an Apgar score is a test that's done at 1 minute and 5 minutes post-birth. And this is done by a certified midwife or certified nurse midwife or physician. And they look at, I think it's five different things. They look at the breathing effort, the heart rate, the muscle tone, the reflexes, and skin color. And they have a scoring system in each of these categories from 0 to 2. The first minute is really looking at the survival of how they did during the birthing process. The 5 minutes is post-birth, how they're doing on those functional levels. So that was a big piece too, is I want to make sure there's medical evaluation done on my child to make sure that we don't need to use any advanced medical intervention.
So question, when this was all new to you, did you just read certain books or were you just checking things out online? Was it talking to people? What was your best resource?
So where I went to school, Bastyr University outside of Seattle, Washington, has a midwifery program. So I had a lot of resources that I had pulled from there, which I was very fortunate to have, and then connected back with them actually for additional resources. And then the meeting I had with my friend Sarah really helped to build this checklist. And so I felt pretty sound with that. And I wanted to make sure also that I could have a home birth versus a birth in a birthing center. Some people say for the first birth, you should have a birthing center in case you need intervention. But I really felt like I wanted to do it at home for a whole lot of reasons. One is to just have the intimate space, to be able to control my environment, to not have to have a drive home from the hospital, to be able to lay in my own bed following the birthing process and to really have the bonding moment with my husband and our baby. And that kind of nesting element, it's a kind of more emotional than a medical level of why I wanted to do a home birth, but a natural birth would be more of the medical piece. And it was important for me that the practitioner I worked with either offered co-care or had a neonatal specialist to transfer to a hospital if needed. And that was the last kind of questions that I was asking them in the interview process was, at what point, you know, do you transfer to a hospital? Do you allow co-care with a physician of my choice, or is there one in particular that you work with? And the midwife that I went with is phenomenal with the West Houston Birth Center, and they have a neonatologist on call when they deliver babies. So they have a particular specialist for advanced complications because they wouldn't want a typical OBGYN. You know, if they're going to accelerate it to the need of an intervention, it's going to be a complication. And so they have someone on call every time they go into a new delivery so that if there needs to be a hospital transfer, that he's going to meet them there. And you don't have to deal with the like big wide eyes by some of the nursing staff of like, what? You were trying to deliver a baby at home? That's crazy, you know.
Right.
It's a really nice, hopefully simple transition if needed.
I just feel like there's so many things.
I know.
So many new things.
Yes.
So you touched on preparation, you know, fertility, continuing the progesterone, But what did you do differently during the first trimester than when you were preparing to get pregnant?
So, I mean, like the biggest things that I missed was my supplement support and my wine. I think like being totally yes. true and vulnerable. Yes. So, I stopped drinking wine the moment that I found out. And I had to make a lot of supplement changes. I say to a lot of my patients that I, of course, believe in food as medicine, but as we've mentioned in the podcast, we also believe that in nutraceuticals and their ability to provide you fuel sources, where there are functional deficiencies and give you that kind of rocket boost approach. And I had a really nice synergy of supplementation going for my system where I felt really kind of rock star-ish on a typical day. And I think that that went hand in hand with the fatigue that I experienced in the first trimester was pulling out a lot of my adaptogen herbs, pulling out my adrenal glandulars and all of those types of things that were helping me get through my daily stress demand. So I thinned out my regimen. No more, again, adrenal support, no more L-theanine, no more catecholamine or sleep aids or herbs. And I had kept in my thorn prenatal. I kept in a good quality fish oil and was more, I would say, disciplined to take that because sometimes I would miss that a couple days of the week. I actually added in an additional methylation, a B methyl formula. So I was rotating between Vessel Care by Metagenics and B Supreme by Designs for Health. And I still do that every other day, rotate. I was consistent with a probiotic. I had been on a probiotic since I stopped the yeast cleanse. And I also have been consistent with eating probiotic-rich foods. So that's something that didn't change daily. And then, of course, I was very focused on the bioidentical progesterone through week 12 and then did stop that to allow the placental support of continuing the progesterone that way. I was on maca prior. I did stop the maca, but just keep the bioidentical progesterone. And then two supplements I brought in were magnesium glycinate and inositol, which are in the form of our rest and regulate powder. I did experience a little bit of constipation with the pregnancy. It's gotten to be more fun. We'll get into that. So I brought in the rest and regulate, which is a form of magnesium, and I was taking that, and inositol helps with insulin resistance. So I was taking that like 3-4 times a week at bed. And then a buffered vitamin C powder as well.
Okay.
That's my thin load.
Yeah. No big deal.
Right.
And so I think we have a pretty good idea of what you experienced through thus far that you've talked about.
Yeah.
But is there anything else just finishing out that you want listeners to know about your first trimester?
Let's see. I think the biggest thing on first trimester that I would share that I wish someone shared with me was the body changes. I've been focused, like I said, for the last 10, 12 years on optimal eating and food as medicine. And so I always maintained a pretty healthy frame and never really dealt with body dysmorphia or issues with my body. But when you're pregnant in the beginning, there's this baby growing inside of you, but yet you don't have the tangible evidence, I guess, of the ultrasound pictures, but you don't feel the baby until especially with your first child, week 20 plus. And so you just kind of have this, I didn't feel the glow. I felt just kind of yuck. Like I said, a little bit constipated, a little bloated, weight gain around my abdominal area. And, I think my first trimester, I gained about 6 pounds, but where it was gathering was really bothering me. I was having a really hard time already at week 8 fitting into my pants, maybe 7. And yet I wasn't big enough to fit into the maternity pants with the stretchy waistbands that I get to rock out these days. And so I ended up just going to Target and buying some clothes that were one or two sizes larger. And that part for me was emotionally just funky and weird and yuck. And I kind of wish someone else had said that to me so I felt less of a jerk. I don't know. I just felt like I was being catty and uncomfortable in my own body. And I felt like I couldn't announce that I was pregnant until week 13. And that's actually when I did, because I wanted to make sure I was out of the high risk miscarriage zone. But yet, being a dietitian and having a lot of patients come see me for weight loss, I felt like I was carrying more weight. You know, it made me uncomfortable, and there was nothing I could do about it. And I wanted to be like, "You jerks, I'm pregnant." So there was that transition. Definitely from week like 8 to 13 was the time that I was just like dying to tell everyone that I was pregnant and just like come out with it. And I was just waiting and hoping for the weight to kind of be more focused. Although it did accumulate in the trunk, I wanted to have a showing belly, so it was like proof. And I really don't think I had to wish that, because now it's like very apparent and it's like, okay.
Yes.
Like, I think back of like how hard I was like, I just can't wait till I'm showing. And now I'm like, okay, well, here it is.
Definitely showing now.
So yeah. Yeah.
Well, we'll be sharing next episode all about second trimester, and then of course the third will come, and then we'll have birthing stories. So y'all are going to be along with us on this journey. I'm going to ask all the questions that I have that, you know, and people, I'm sure people are dying to hear.
Yeah.
And it's really good to hear. Everyone has a different story, but it's really great to hear from a functional medicine practitioner that you've got trying to be your own doctor, as if Brady was saying, but also trying to release and just not overdiagnose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, hands off the wheel per se, but we'll talk in our second trimester episode about my experiences with petechiae and anemia and opting out of my oral glucose tolerance test, which is another kind of fun element of the conventional approaches of prenatal care, and why I opted out of that and what I did as an alternative, as well as fun stuff like feeling the baby kick and the gender reveal and so much more. I'm excited to share, and I'm hoping that you guys are all enjoying the release, the story.
And I get to enjoy the baby clothes shopping.
Yes. So hopefully you enjoyed this lighter episode. You didn't have to take so many notes. As always, tune in on AllieMillerRD.com. Check out our blog, check out our podcast page, our virtual classes, and make sure on the podcast page that you leave your questions at the Ask Allie box. In the next couple episodes, we will be doing another Q&A feature. So throw us your burning questions, and we're happy to help with our food as medicine expertise.
Thanks as always for listening. Bye, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Naturally Nourished podcast. Visit our blog at AllieMillerRD.com for recipes, wellness tips, and food as medicine meal plans. Connect with Allie and Carly at AllieMillerRD on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Until next time, stay nourished and be well.